Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, we started out on the grass reading Luke 19, and the people were shouting as Jesus came into Jerusalem, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And then we sang, "All glory, laud, and honor to thee, Redeemer, King." It seemed like we were getting ready for a coronation. And coronations, of course, are full of loud festivities, great food, nice clothing, jewels, and celebrations. But we wound up, of course, in a very different place. We wound up on Golgotha, the place of the skull where criminals were put to death. The disconnect is incredible. We started off waiting for a coronation, anticipating a coronation, and we wound up on the skull, being crucified as a criminal. So what happened? I would suggest that the thread of coronation actually ought to be followed all the way from the triumphal entry, which we celebrated out on the grass, to the skull. To Golgotha, the place where Jesus was crucified. I believe that because of the discussion that Jesus had with these two criminals, one on his left, one on his right. The word for criminal literally is could be translated as evildoers. These were people that did bad things, and they were condemned as criminals, and they were put to death. It must have been serious crimes that they committed, because, again, they were given the sentence of crucifixion. And as these two criminals talked with Jesus, we see something revealing. The first criminal cries out to Jesus, "If you're the Messiah, save yourself. Oh, and us too, while you're at it." And this echoes the Jewish leaders who said, "If this is the Messiah, let him save himself." And then the Roman soldiers, "If you're really a king, come down from the cross." And then, now, the criminal beside Jesus, "If you're really the Messiah, come down, save us." And this, of course, echoes Luke chapter 4, after Jesus had been baptized and the voice from heaven had said to him, "This is my son, my beloved. With you I'm well pleased." Immediately after that, we heard Satan come to Jesus and say, "If you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God, make the stone bread, throw yourself off the mountain, if you'll only worship me, if you're the Son of God." And so the voices of the religious leaders, the political powers, the common criminals, are all casting doubt on what it means for Jesus to be a king, what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah. If you're the Messiah, save yourself. If you're the Messiah, get us down off these crosses. If you're really a king, come down from that cross. But Jesus, of course, is in fact a king. In his dialogue with Pilate, this comes out in John's gospel more clearly, it's clear that Jesus is a king, but he's not like any king that the world has ever known or has seen since. He's not a king that comes with pomp and circumstance. He's not a king that comes with jewels. He's not a king that comes with a sword. He's a king that, paradoxically, comes through offering himself as a sacrifice. The first criminal doesn't see this. He only sees Jesus as a failure, someone who made grand claims about himself and who allowed his followers to make similar grand claims about him, and now found himself being crucified as a criminal. And he mocked Jesus. In the Greek, the word that's translated derided in our text is literally blaspheme. He blasphemed Jesus. "You're a failure, Jesus. You're a joke. You're an imposter. I can't believe what you're doing. I can't believe what you've said about yourself. I can't believe what these people have said about you. But the other criminal sees something entirely different. Somehow, the presence of Jesus' suffering on the cross evoked faith in this second criminal. What the second criminal saw was actually a coronation, not a failure, but rather a coronation. What the second criminal saw was this man who is suffering. And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And so Jesus, rather than coming down from the cross, rather than getting the criminals off the cross, knew that the way that he was going to become the king was to endure the pain and to endure the suffering of the cross. We see all throughout the Gospels Jesus announcing the presence of the kingdom. And he does this with his words, but he also does it with his deeds. He brings broken bodies back to wholeness. He sets people free from demonic oppression. He announces forgiveness of sin. He reconciles those who have been estranged from God and from one another. The problem, though, with these manifestations of God's kingdom is that the people whose bodies were healed eventually died. The one who was set free from demonic oppression eventually died. The one whose sins were forgiven eventually died. The one who was reconciled to community eventually died. All of them died. And so for the kingdom to fully come, death, that final decisive enemy, needed to be defeated. And this is only going to happen by the king going to the cross, enduring the pain of the cross, enduring the humiliation and the shame of the cross, and ultimately enduring final separation from the Father and death on the cross. The first criminal saw this as folly. The second criminal saw this as Jesus coming into his kingdom. Somehow God allowed the second criminal to see in Jesus the means by which his kingdom was coming. And it's interesting, as alongside of the man's faith in Jesus was also an awareness of his own guilt. Now he tells the first criminal, "Look, we're both here because we did some bad stuff. We deserve to be here. This man's done nothing wrong." Again, something about being in the presence of Jesus' suffering evoked not only a belief, a faith in Jesus, but also an awareness of his own guilt. This is much like Peter in Luke chapter 5, when Jesus instructed him to throw his net over the other side, teaching the fishermen how to fish. And when Peter does it grudgingly, just because Jesus had asked him to, he pulls out the miraculous catch. And Peter's response is to ask Jesus to leave because Peter is so aware of his own sin at that moment. And Jesus is manifesting his true self, and Peter's aware of his guilt. And so the second criminal sees Jesus suffering on the cross, and he becomes aware of his guilt. But somehow, in the man's guilt, rather than saying, "Oh, woe is me," and lapse into hopeless despair, he calls on Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And so the man had faith that Jesus might do something about his guilt. This one who was suffering humiliation, shame, and on his way to death, had something to say about this guilty man's future state. And Jesus' response, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," is important. He didn't say, "Okay, well, sometime in the future, thousands and thousands of years from now, we'll put everything right and you'll be okay." He actually said, "Today." And Jesus was coming in his kingdom even as he was dying on the cross. And the word paradise is an interesting one. It's only used two other times in the New Testament. Once in 2 Corinthians when Paul was describing his heavenly journey. He was caught up into the third heaven, caught up to paradise. And then at the end of Revelation, we read about the presence of God in the garden of paradise. In the Old Testament, this Greek word paradise, which actually has Persian roots, was often used to describe the Garden of Eden. And this demonstrates for us that the cross of Jesus, that the death of Jesus is bringing forth a new creation. That it's through the cross of Jesus that God is beginning to recreate, to restore, to renew his broken but beautiful creation. But it's through the death of Jesus. If Jesus had come down from the cross, we would not be saved. If Jesus had come down from the cross, the new creation that God came, or that Christ came to inaugurate, would not have been inaugurated. But it takes something miraculous for people like us to view a man suffering shame and humiliation and on his way to death, for us to look at that and say, this is the means by which God is restoring, renewing, and redeeming creation. And as we do that, we're mindful of our own guilt. We're mindful that we've fallen short. We're mindful that we're part of the problem. But we simply ask Jesus to remember us when he comes into his kingdom. We're guilty. We don't deserve mercy. We don't deserve grace. We're on the cross justly. But we simply ask Jesus, the one who's coming into his kingdom, the one who's being coronated, crowned as king on the cross, that when he comes into his kingdom, would he remember us? And Jesus says a resounding yes. And not some time in the unforeseen future, but rather today. And so as we embark on our journey through Holy Week, walking with Jesus the way of the cross, my hope and prayer for each one of us is that we would see the shame and the humiliation and the disgrace and the suffering and the death on the cross as the means by which God has chosen to renew and recreate and restore his beautiful but broken creation, of which we play a guilty role. My hope and prayer is that we would see that, and that we would be drawn to it, that we would be compelled by it, and that we would begin to pray, remember me, Jesus, when you come into your kingdom. Remember me, Jesus, when you come into your kingdom. And that as he says today, that we would experience his kingdom today, and that we would know what it looks like for the God who chose to renew creation through the shame and the humiliation of the cross to be present to us, that we might know that he is, in fact, the king not only of Israel, not only of the world, but even of the whole cosmos. That as we walk with Jesus this Holy Week, that we would know that he is the one who's calling us into paradise, even today. Amen.